You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 8, given on the 20th of May, 1917, in Munich. From yesterday's talk, you could see how in our times human beings find themselves in the midst of humanity's overall evolution. It was shown to some extent by human evolution itself and by what comes toward individual personalities, how this evolution has increasingly awakened a drive to fire the inner soul, to awaken it, because humans have become ever less able to make progress in external terms without drawing on their inner resources. That is the gist of what spiritual science intends, to lead human individuals toward the possibility of striding ahead, whereas in ancient times, simply because each human was born into humanity, they had a given number of experiences that endowed them with a certain level of maturity. You will feel that knowledge of such a fact, as outlined yesterday, is of immense importance and fundamentally illuminates what is needed by human beings of our time. One can only enter into this properly, in the sense of a spiritual scientist, by looking with wide-open eyes at the ways in which present humans relate to human evolution as a whole. Infinitely significant discoveries can be made here. But these discoveries have to be made in such a way that one is in a position to evaluate the facts. There are people today who feel it necessary to extend their soul beyond its boundaries, in other words, beyond the age of 27. But the courage and energy which today creates such wonders in the external world, that courage and energy to really unfold inner soul forces, are not found so frequently today. That is how it comes about that we meet people who in their own ways strive to find something other than what exists in the surrounding culture and tasks of the times. Yet they lack the courage to approach the working methods, attitudes, and ethos that long for something genuinely new, that is, for spiritual science. We find that such people do not clearly say to themselves, but instead they feel, in times gone by, the surrounding world bequeathed more to humans, so we ought to look for what the world once gave humanity. We need to regain access to those ancient gifts once more. That is the reason why those more inclined to long for the spirit take refuge, I'd say due to a lack of strength, in all sorts of long superseded, long surpassed stages of human evolution. Examples of this abound. One such is very typical, the writer Maurice Barres, who with youthful impetuosity wanted, one could say, to storm the spiritual heavens, then sought to join some new spiritual movement or other, but lacking the requisite courage, found his affiliation with Catholicism, as do so many today. Yet it is an odd attitude that seeks their path in a backward instead of a forward direction. The words in which Barres describes his striving toward Catholicism are the predictable testimony of someone lacking all courageous drive or energy of soul, who, because they can muster no will to seek anything new, clutch at what is old. How he clutches is what is typical. Just take the words of a spirit such as Barres, a product of today's education, who stands fully within it, and from it has evolved his inclination toward Catholicism. Quote, seeking what is yonder is a waste of effort. Maybe it doesn't even exist. Close quote. Just think, after aligning himself with Catholicism, he speaks of yonder worlds in terms such as these. Quote, seeking what is yonder is a waste of effort. Maybe it doesn't even exist. However much we grab hold of it, we cannot experience anything of it. Let's leave occultism to the enlightened and the street entertainers. whichever form mysticism may assume, it contradicts reason. So let us just give ourselves to the Church." Close quote. Just think about that. Quote, "Firstly, because it is indissolubly bound up with France's tradition. Further, because it has been formulated with the authority of centuries and has great practical experience of the ethical rules it must teach people and children. And, lastly, because far from supplying us with mysticism, it directly defends us against it, commanding the voices of the mysterious groves to silence, setting out the Gospels and sacrificing the magnanimous anarchism of the Redeemer to the needs of modern society." Close quote. Here you see the motivation of someone typical of the present, driven to search for the Spirit in their own particular way, grasping for what humanity, without human effort, once possessed. He just takes it without making any demands on the real sense of what he is taking. One might call this cynical or frivolous, were there not considerable seriousness and striving behind it. And that is just what is so ominous and disastrous. The serious nature of the striving itself becomes frivolous because of its relation to time. Don't take such words lightly. The most damaging disservices to our time are rooted in the fact that human beings are always inclined to take things flippantly. Countless other examples, similar to that of Barres, could be cited. They would all demonstrate, in their multifarious ways, the attribute of our times just mentioned. We ask ourselves, what is the underlying reason for this? We ask this because it is important to recognize how we need to do things differently. We can only find our way properly forward if we have some insight into the present calamity, into what underlies an attitude such as this. We have to look back a little over human evolution if we want to understand the present, and we do not need to understand it. We have to look back a little over human evolution if we want to understand the present, and we do need to understand it, if we want to make headway. If we go back over the evolution of European humanity and associated Asiatic populations, we only need to go back as far as the first third of post-Atlantean times. We find what even external research confirms, that people could clearly differentiate between the three basic elements of the human constitution. That archaic, dimly dreamlike awareness arose, enabling them to distinguish between these three attributes. This is why I gave particular emphasis in my book titled Theosophy to the fact that these three fundamental constituents have to underlie the overall structure of the human being. Going back, we see that human beings viewed humankind as comprising body, soul, and spirit. Just think what confusion reigns today, even among those seeking clarity, in terms of an overview of the human constituents of body, soul, and spirit. You can scroll through philosophy after philosophy. You can study Wundt, who is not only well known in Germany, but studied worldwide, quote, with passionate resolution, close quote, and you will see that the man cannot differentiate between soul and spirit, despite that ability being amongst today's most basic requirements. When did it widely come to light that people were muddling up soul and spirit? As I said, you will find this everywhere. The human being is divided into body and soul, and mixed into the soul without any distinguishing features, also some spirit. This came to sharp expression in the year 869 at the Council of Constantinople, when the spirit was abolished, banished, forgive the harsh expression, because the teachings then formulated culminated largely in creating the doctrine that human beings contained a thinking soul and a spirit-like soul. The spirit was therefore dispatched, and a still-sensed fragment of it smuggled into the soul, whereby it was claimed that the soul has thinking capacity and some spiritual attributes. Then followed the Middle Ages with its, in many respects, admirable scholastic research. Yet this still existed under the vigorous constraints of that doctrine of 869. And any so-called trichotomy, or threefold stratification, was severely frowned upon. The spirit had to be omitted everywhere, This defines the way in which soul and spirit are considered, or rather not considered, by modern academicians, who according to their own statements carry out premise-free science. They simply don't acknowledge those premises, as set out in the resolutions of the Council of Constantinople in 869. The fact that the academics have no inkling upon what they actually depend is the reason they deem themselves to be unconditionally premise-free. Those are the facts of the matter. They need to be heard and energetically focused upon. There is no point shutting one's eyes to them. If anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is to become, for human beings, what it is intended to become, in accordance with the laws of human evolution, such things have to be kept in view, while an understanding of the threefold structure of the human being, as body, soul, and spirit, has to be restored to humanity. Just as, on the one hand, the body exists between birth or conception and death, and is the physical facilitator of consciousness, so must the spirit be recognized as the spiritual facilitator of higher consciousness, which human beings have to develop between death and a new birth. This is deeply allied with the momentous inner circumstances of life in modern humanity. Let's take something typical of our times, thinking, about which we must say it has become an abstraction, though the occasional person may transcend this abstraction, is largely based in public life on three abstract ideas. Nowadays, in the world at large, we see these three abstract ideas being brought to bear against Central Europe. This central area of Europe will only take up its spiritual task if it accustoms itself to making the three abstract ideas into concrete ideas, ideas that are drenched in reality. These three concepts were driven into consciousness with great fervor at the end of the 18th century in the words fraternity, freedom, and equality. They almost remind us of three quite concrete concepts, which are only now understood in abstract terms, but which were embodied in human consciousness in terms conceived as appropriate to the reality of those times. They remind us of faith, hope, and love. But let's stay for a moment with fraternity, freedom, and equality. It is spectral, shadowy thinking that seeks to actualize these three concepts across the modern world. Everything of this ilk, in pursuit of which human souls make such efforts, rests upon the fact that people have no inclination to penetrate reality. They can do no more with these three great cardinal concepts than they do with the new policy of realignment, that each human being should be deployed in the position best befitting them. They announce nice ideas, create abstract concepts out of those ideas, but have no inclination to commit to reality. This reality consists of an understanding of spiritual science. In the same way as spirit and soul are intermingled in confusion, so are freedom, equality, and fraternity jumbled together. The idea of fraternity, of brotherliness, will only be capable of being rightly grasped by humanity once you are clear that human beings only fully exist on this physical plane with one of their constituent elements, in corporeal incarnation. We exist on a physical level, in physical embodiment, which connects us with all humankind through blood and other commonalities. Just think back to olden times about the way in which physical humans related to other physical humans. They did not just contain what they inherited from their parents, but also encompassed the immortal element which accompanied them through births and deaths, configuring itself into corporeality over the course of incarnations. In ancient times, as I outlined yesterday, human beings were capable of co-experiencing what was spiritual in the environment while eating, breathing, and digesting. It was one of their capacities. Due to this, they incorporated something largely instinctive, which we might call an agglomeration of feelings, sensations, concepts, and imagination, which governed their attitudes and behavior toward their fellow human beings. This was instinctive in them, and we see it decreasing over time. The terrible eruptions of hate, which we now encounter, can only be understood in terms of their real underlying cause, if we understand how the old instincts are on the wane. These hateful instincts are far more serious than is acknowledged today. Terrible things will be experienced as a result of this condition. And if what needed to be overcome in evolutionary terms was not conquered, the instinct to hate would become ever greater and greater. Even if individual people largely tend, in an age of freedom from authority and premise-free science, toward being led by the nose, sensations streaming up from their subconscious hinder this. Such people tend to look for all sorts of leaders. The more aberrantly and unconditionally they seek to follow such leaders, the more are they exposed to the danger of their apparent love degenerating into hatred. This is not something that can be overcome by criticizing, because it is deeply rooted in human evolution, and the more human love is just preached as an abstract idea and abstract fraternity likewise, the more does mutual antagonism unfold. This is another truth, upon which we need to focus most seriously and deeply, if we are to understand the present. What has to happen is that an outlook that accepts repeated earthly lives, that accepts reincarnation, has to be transformed into feelings, into perceptions. Just being a theoretical adherent of reincarnation doesn't amount to anything. Taking as a whole what we have attempted to draw together in order to extract from the laws of human evolution as they pertain over time, what enables us to focus on concrete facts and not just abstract ideas. There exists in every human being an element that traverses births and deaths, and this transforms abstraction into experienced perceptions, not into instincts as they previously existed subconsciously, but into conscious instincts with which people can somehow be challenged. Nowadays, there is an all too strong desire to take up the idea of reincarnation in selfish terms. How often have we seen people desperate to know all about their own previous incarnations? This cannot be the practical outcome of the concept of repeated earth lives. A genuine outcome would entail learning increasingly to see every individual you meet as though they contained far more than could be lived within their single earthly life. What is often called a feeling of distance may arise, which in due proportion is a feeling for finding the right relationship toward the other person, not deifying them, yet seeking ever more deeply to find within them the element enduring through eternity. It is false mysticism to brood endlessly within oneself. The kind of mysticism we need is of the sort that guides us toward practical but emphatically human knowledge, so that we avoid judging any individual from the outset as being either sympathetic or antagonistic, but are instead conscious that every human soul is actually an infinite riddle. If this idea is seriously taken to heart, what streams from out of repeated earthly lives, what pours into our souls, is something which, if rightly understood in the context of modern humanity, ought to be experienced as brotherliness. This brotherly love will not, in typical manner, seek ever and again to help others in a form pleasing to ourselves, but it will want to commit to helping others in ways appropriate to them, so that they are helped in accordance with their own deepest self. A thought such as this will also prevent us from the cavalier criticism that so often erects barriers between us and others and which hinders us from seeing impartially what lives in the other person. Only when the concept of repeated earthly incarnations is alive in our souls, practically and vigorously, will the idea of brotherliness assume the right form and represent what human beings have in common, what they mean for each other through being embodied. A second aspect of human evolution is that we not only acknowledge the physical nature of the human being, the only aspect to which materialism wishes to admit, but that we recognize the human soul, that we ascribe to each person a conscious soul. we are not ascribing a soul to someone whom we endeavor to subjugate to our own ethos. That is, if we are of the opinion that we really are respecting their soul while expecting them to share our way of thinking. We have to grant a soul freedom. It cannot merely be ascribed to its body. Freedom is the only salient feature between souls, the only quality that matters. And the root of freedom is freedom of thought. Once you properly understand this second element of humankind, a soul in addition to a body, you will no longer confuse freedom and fraternity, but will instead say, brotherliness is necessary because humans have to establish for themselves a social order defined by fraternity. A social structure defined by fraternity has to come about. But unless people are enthused by really practical ideas about brotherliness, they will find no state structures within which human beings can sensibly live together. If people fail to recognize within these state structures that human beings live not only as physical bodies but also as soul entities, they will never be able to conceive of freedom in the right way. This is because freedom lies in soul-to-soul conduct and not between bodies. The freedom required by bodies arises automatically as a necessary consequence of inter-soul freedom having become widespread. This, however, requires that we finally learn not to foist our own thoughts onto other people, but allow each soul its own valid direction of thought. Above all, we need to acquire a sense for reality, because in no other areas can one sin more than in those of science and religion. I can only ever refer, by way of example, to something that happened in a South German town. I was giving a lecture about wisdom and Christianity. Being Southern Germany, there were two Catholic priests in the audience. Afterward, they said to me, "According to what you said today, one cannot object, in terms of content, to what you claim. Yet one cannot agree with it." I asked why. "The main issue," they said, "is that you say all these things about Christianity, such as can be understood by those with a certain level of erudition and certain requirements and so on. However, we are looking for a manner of speaking that is accessible to all people. We shape our thoughts such that everyone can agree with them." I replied, "Your Grace, you know that the way you and I think about what humbles us all, what makes us all devout, comes to both of us. Both you and I can imagine this, and each one of us will, of course, be totally convinced that our image is the right one, unless we have developed a sense for reality. We would be peculiar old fogies were we to create ideas whose suitability for all humanity we were to doubt. But what you or I think suitable for all humankind, each according to our individual development, is not the point. That is ultimately irrelevant, and we need to transcend that through proper, active, practical self-knowledge. The decisive factor is to study reality, and to ask what dictates reality. What does time and its contents teach us as to what people need? What do people's longings teach us? From this another question arises from the one you posed, namely, does everyone go to your church nowadays? If you are to speak to all people, wouldn't they all flock to you?" They couldn't avoid answering, "Admittedly, not everyone still goes to church." I then said, "So, you see, among those in today's audience were mainly those who no longer go to church, but who also have a right to find their way to Christ, and it was to them that I was speaking." One should not, just on the basis of one's own opinion, conceive ideas as to what people need, but rather in accordance with what reality is telling us. it is less comfortable to study reality. You have to keep adjusting how you deploy your observational senses and have sufficient willpower to ask repeatedly, what are the real needs of the times? How do things stand? What are they asking of us? Unless this practical sense, which has to underlie freedom of thought, has infiltrated people's souls, we will not achieve corresponding soul-to-soul relationships. Just as the social fabric toward which humanity must aim is dependent on us arriving at truthful insights, in the sense of spiritual science, into corporeality and the idea of fraternity, in the same way do we have to grasp and make real concepts of soul and freedom of thought in the areas of science, education, and religious ethos. A third element is the spirit. If it is now possible to reinstate the spirit in its rightful place, and to reverse what the Council of Constantinople decreed in 869, then what may pertain practically for human life in future will also be valid for the spirit. Today we have two tendencies. One follows the same direction as the Council of Constantinople, which translates into banishing the spirit. A monistic worldview strives to banish the soul likewise. Those of the opinion that natural scientific monism contains so much tolerance, in today's sense of the word, that it could never bring itself to overturn a council and expel the soul, as well, are mistaken in their thinking. The propensity mentioned is prepared not only to proscribe the spirit, but also the soul. Those who today are mini monists will want to mushroom into great monists, and though they claim to disdain overturning that council, because they are, after all, free spirits, having freed themselves of all spirit, they will seek to allow certain usages and customs to become normalized. It will come about, do not take this to be a joke, that the soul will be eliminated. In addition to all the physical medicines that exist today, a whole raft of others will be added to treat those who talk of things as fantastical as spirits and souls. They will be remediated and will be medicated against all talk of spirits or souls. Spirit could just be discarded. Soul will only be driven out of people by medically treating the body. Though this may appear monstrous today, the thrust of certain objectives will arrive at the point of inventing medicines to vaccinate children with all sorts of agents, whereby their physical organism is so debilitated as to allow materialistic attitudes to thrive rather well in them, when it will no longer be a matter of treating the ancient idea of soul and spirit as anything other than something people once believed in olden days and which can be consigned to smug amusement. Saying things of this nature may seem like madness to some, but if we don't muster the courage to admit them to ourselves, we will never find the energy to unfold and kindle spiritual scientific spirituality in our souls. This is why, in addition to the tendency just mentioned, which wishes to dispense with the soul, because it will be viewed as a pathology, there must be another, that of energetically resubstantiating that, in addition to a body, the human being bears within them both a soul and a spirit. To effect knowledge of the spirit, you will need to ensure that spiritual science becomes truly embedded, that people understand which elements actually belong to their being once they traverse the portal of death. Among the old folk maxims, which so often convey benign outlooks into the modern world, is this: in death all are equal, because then everyone becomes a spirit, and because the idea of equality is one which corresponds with spirit. Equality among spirits, equality to spirits. The three ideals of freedom, fraternity, and equality can no longer be mixed and muddled together, but one needs to know, in concrete terms of reality, what human beings are, and that they are to be free in their souls, fraternal as regards their bodies, and that people must be equal in the realm of their spirits. Because inequality among people does exist, a specialization occasioned by the spirit having to be specialized in body and soul. Pneumatology, spiritual doctrine, spiritual perspective or view, is the foundation of the concept of equality. Thus we have before us the remarkable phenomenon of chaotic expressions bursting forth across the world at the end of the 18th century, crying, fraternity, freedom, and equality. However, we will eventually need to understand that the only means of realizing the ideals of brotherliness, freedom, and equality will be once we are in a condition to add to them knowledge of the threefold nature of the human being as body, soul, and spirit. This was the basis upon which I attempted so energetically in my title, Theosophy, to stratify the human being into body, soul, and spirit. This organization is a challenge for our times and for the near future. It is only by transforming these concepts into practice and in learning to perceive human beings practically in terms of body, soul, and spirit that one is able to evolve beyond the age of 27. Otherwise, one will remain stuck at the age of 27. Think of the prospects. A sixth and seventh cultural epoch will follow our fifth age. In the sixth epoch, humanity as a whole will attain the equivalent of what is individually reached between the ages of 14 and 21. In the external world, however clever the people leading education may be, you will not absorb any more than corresponds with what an individual attains by the age of 21. You will not grow more in maturity than 21. Though you may live well beyond that. In the seventh post-Atlantean epoch, you will not mature beyond the individual equivalent of 14. If you fail to grow older by means of kindling inner fire, humankind will suffer an epidemic of youthful feeble-mindedness. Whoever has eyes to see and ears to hear, and whoever doesn't just live their life thoughtlessly, will, armed with knowledge such as this, be in a position to correctly evaluate phenomena already appearing today. To take just one area, where has our era progressed in terms of its view of Christ's impetus? How many people remain close to Barra's opinion that the generous world outlook of the Redeemer is best served by the Church, that this is precisely the reason one can so easily get along with the Church? Who makes the effort? Certainly, individuals may still, but in general, who really exerts themselves to allow what is contained in the Gospels to be resurrected in them? How Christ contrasted what others stood for, and above all, what he had to oppose. The most meaningful, the most profound aspects of Christianity, how are they fathomed today? I will just remind you of a central tenet of Christianity, the coming of the kingdoms of heaven. Even Blavatsky mocked the prediction that the kingdoms of heaven would come, that in the time they were to have come, wheat had not grown more prolifically than before, grapes had not become larger. In short, the kingdom of heaven had not arrived on earth. People think themselves very clever, but such cleverness yields nothing more than opinions of this sort. Cleverness fails to ask, could Christ have meant something different? Christ is recognized today, but only to the extent to which people wish that their own ideas, and the way they themselves conceive of them, also live in Christ. The socialist makes of Christ a good socialist, the liberal an exemplary liberal, the Protestant unionist a representative of liberal unionism, and so on. A modern scholastic theologian, such as Professor Harnack, construes him one way, and people listen to how Professor Harnack speaks about the most important ideas around Christ Jesus. It so happened that I was to hold a lecture in an association, whose chairman was a man well versed in the Bible and theology. During the course of that lecture, I said that the good Professor Harnack actually had a remarkable grasp of the resurrection, because in his paper titled The Essence of Christianity, there appeared the extraordinary sentence, quote, "Whatever may have gone on in the Garden of Gethsemane can no longer be judged, because it transcends human knowledge, and because it also goes beyond the justified demands of belief. Yet the belief in resurrection originates in the Garden of Gethsemane, and this has proved especially valuable to humanity." Close quote. Whether it is true that Christ was somehow resurrected doesn't concern him. One should just believe that the belief in the resurrection originated in the Garden of Gethsemane. That is Harnack's doctrine. The man who was chairman of that association said, quote, "You must be mistaken, because that would virtually make Harnack a Catholic." Close quote. The man in question felt himself to be a superior Protestant. Quote, "That would be tantamount to Catholicism, which maintains that no matter where the scrap of material purported to be the cassock of Trier originates, nor whence comes the tiny bone they worship, what matters is only that faith has spread, and that they are tokens originating from a particular saint. That is Catholic." Close quote, opine that man, continue quote, "and we can obviously not believe in that." Close quote. And that made it all of no consequence. Whether Harnack thought it was neither here nor there, whether it was true that Christ was resurrected or not, but just that one believed the belief to have originated in the Garden of Gethsemane. So he told me that I was mistaken. I replied, quote, "But you know, he wrote that in titled The Essence of Christianity." Close quote. Quote, "No," came the riposte, "that cannot be so. Have you read it?" "Yes, often," I said. "I will send you a postcard with chapter and verse from The Essence of Christianity, where that is stated." Close quote. The man who was so well versed in theology and was so Bible knowledgeable was not able to read closely enough to know what that book is contained. But the book contains what I reported. That's the state of modern thinking. Modern thinking has a strange propensity, in all areas, but especially where efforts have been made, to popularize things. It is not only theologians who prove to be sinful. Natural scientists can be equally so. There is a booklet titled The Mechanics of Spiritual Life. I don't know if there's also a booklet on the iron qualities of wood. The author whom I value, as I do all those whom I tackle, bears the name Favorne. In this booklet, he deals with dreams and states that while dreaming, brain activity is tuned down and numbed down and is only partially active. If someone taps lightly on the window with a pin, says Favorne, we might dream that cannon are firing a volley of shots. That's a well-known dream, and he starts with that statement. Further claims intervene, and at the end of that page he states, dreams bear their strange nature because brain activity is tuned down. Just think of the ingenuity. When we are in possession of our full brain function, we hear the faint tapping of a pin on the window. When the brain is tuned down and less active, we hear cannon fire. This explanation is accepted and applauded, as is much of Freud, just because a few lines separate those statements. This sort of thing is fundamental in our time. The will to really follow up on the thoughts we encounter is very rare nowadays. It is therefore not hard to understand why one would not, without further ado, want to comprehend an imponderable such as the coming of the, quotes, kingdom of heaven, because quite something is entailed. Until the time of the mystery of Golgotha, the kingdoms of heaven drew near to human beings in dreamlike manner. Before the Atlantean cataclysm, they were even absorbed during digestion. But now they had to descend. They did indeed descend, but in such a way that human beings had to exert their spirits to encompass the kingdoms of heaven. The grapes growing larger, the ears of wheat being more fulsome, is not what is meant, but instead that the kingdom exists in our very midst, and it is we who must fortify our own spirits in order to find it. What I have just sketched briefly is what underlies the magnificent conception of Christ Jesus. It is, however, a concept that requires our soul's energy if we wish to find our way into it. Many Christian concepts are like this. With them, Christ Jesus stood up to the Roman Empire, the Imperium Romanum, which had taken shape in a way completely divergent from that of Christianity. This Roman Empire, which had swelled into tyrannous Caesarism, had, in exercising its power, placed the ancient mysteries under its dominion. Augustus was the first Caesar who, on account of his external power, had to be initiated into the mysteries. His successors, Tiberius, Caligula, and others, were also initiated into the mysteries. They only applied their mystery knowledge to the kingdom of the outer world, and did not, in the way of Egyptian temple priests, take the kingdom of the spirit out into the worldly realm. Commodus even had himself made an initiator, and when initiating an acolyte was meant to strike him symbolically, but did so with such force that he is said to have slain him. Here two mighty contradictions come face to face, the Roman Empire and Christianity. This antithesis had to find its resolution. To this day it has not yet found any such equilibrium. We have to become capable of recognizing the Spirit and also of bringing it into life. I will say only this much. Because what entered us largely persists in our thinking as in our feelings, in the form of logic. The manner of thinking and feeling prevalent in the Roman Empire. Our grammar school students first learned Latin, and with it the mode of thinking inherited from the Roman Empire, which has been self-perpetuating. We no longer know how much has to be attributed to this inner root nerve, this innervating foundation of our lives. Nor do we yet know how rightly to seek the spirit path leading to Christ. Such a path can only be one that includes will for thinking, something that has degenerated in our times. In fact, one could actually call it intelligence. Our age, which is so proud of intelligence, has actually divested itself of intelligence because it dispenses with conscientiousness based on thinking. A widely read booklet on the subject of Christianity and the battle between present world views reproduces lectures given to thousands and thousands of people by a leading contemporary figure who has obviously studied law, medicine, philosophy, and even, alas, theology. Their ideas are elaborated, which could drive you to climb the walls. And at the end of it, you even have to traipse through the lovely words which Goethe is purported to have said, quote, "No created spirit penetrates into nature's inner core. Happy he to whom she even shows her outer shell." Close quote. These are the lengths to which we have to go in acknowledging such a thought. The lecturer knows his Goethe so well that he cites a Hallerian quotation as being one of Goethe's, even though Goethe had responded to that very verse by saying, quote, "I curse at it, but furtively. Nature has neither core nor shell. She is everything, all at once. Test yourself, as is mostly all you do, whether you be core or shell." Close quote. This is how people are fobbed off with a worldview purported to be that of Goethe, who himself retorted, quote, "I curse at it," close quote. Yet people listen only too willingly, and that reflects the general state of thinking today. There is no point in looking aloft salaciously at certain ideas issuing from spiritual science. These ideas need to completely settle into your soul life. Then that other stream, the spiritual stream which prevents the present mode of thinking from engulfing humankind through allowing the individual to self-evolve, will enable what already exists to flow out into evolution as a whole. Much will have to happen before such things are rightly taken hold of in concrete terms, terms under which they are grasped so thoroughly that reality-supporting thinking can reach humanity. A good book has come out called The State as a Form of Life by Kellan, the well-known Swedish state sociologist. I only mention this because he has shown great goodwill toward our issue, toward my issue, such that you should not think I bear him any grudge or rancor. Just for this reason, I may use him as an example of certain ways of living. Kellan attempts to formulate ideas about the state, which, due to their assorted errors, could well become widespread. He obviously comes back to the idea of the state as an organism. He is ahead of Wilson. Wilson, in his time, was sharply critical of people of Newton's time, who had not had independent ideas about the state, but had allowed themselves to be so influenced by the theory of gravity that they judged the various impulses in human thinking in abstract terms of gravity. The state was to be conceived of as an organism. In saying this, he failed to notice that people were thinking in Newtonian terms, while he was thinking like a Darwinian. Kellan also considers the state to be an organism, with individuals representing its cells. Well, certainly you can compare an entity containing signs of life with an organism and its cells. You can actually compare anything with anything if the ideas are unwilling to plunge down into reality. Ultimately, you can even compare a lizard with a penknife. Everything is comparable. Only when you have engendered a sense of reality does a comparison lead, of itself, to a correct inference. This comparison would have led Kellan to conceive of one state being an organism and the second as bordering it adjacently. Whoever thinks in accordance with reality will find it impossible to think of human beings as cells. A valid comparison might involve thinking of a totality of states with single states as cells. However, the human being doesn't figure at all in this scenario of a state, in which case only the entirety of social life across the globe would be comparable with an organism. If one then wanted to add people, it would look like this. Let's imagine an organism. Cells would need to protrude from it, much like a strange sort of hedgehog. Only, were it to be an organism like this, one out of which living entities protruded, would it be an organism with which one could compare all social life on Earth? What this means is, all human life cannot be subsumed into the state. It must project outward into the spiritual, from what the state is able to encompass. That is something all too easily forgotten in all areas of practical life. You could bring in example after example to illustrate how one forgets this, and how one forgets, alongside all things external, as modeled upon the Roman Empire, the realm of the Spirit, which Christ sought to bring to the earth. We need to dignify that thought in all its seriousness. You know, whenever things start to become concrete, thinking does not usually reach far enough to plummet. Just think how everything has recently conspired to suppress the autonomy of academic education, so that everything dependent on centers of learning is forced into forms subservient to state policies. Today, in order for a doctor to become a doctor at all, they are first required to have passed the state's civil service exam, after which they are entitled to use the title doctor almost as a kind of decoration. The autonomy of spiritual or intellectual institutions as such has been completely set back and suppressed. We could cite many examples of instances where there is great enthusiasm for moving in that direction. People cannot do enough to make all titles state-compliant. Engineer was synonymous with ingenium or talent, and now people no longer aim to be one such, but just aim for the diploma. If it states on the diploma that you are an engineer, then you are allowed to call yourself one, otherwise no amount of ingenium will come to your aid. All this detracts from a spiritual conception of the world. But people don't think about that. Quite the opposite, they are enthused by this battle, across the board, against all things spiritual. To bring this to our notice, because people are so fond of wordage, one ought perhaps to invent a new word and say, people are not enthused but embodied about de-spiritualization. Then perhaps the odd individual might start to take notice of the direction of travel being pursued. Not taking notice is proof of the thoughtlessness of life, of the hatred leveled against any will to think. So you see how necessary it is to introduce spiritual science into the most everyday details of daily life. Spiritual science is a serious matter. That is why, in addition to the remarkable figures of yesterday, aspects of the immediate present had to be mentioned, because the nature of spiritual science cannot be compromised by being made Philistine or cliquish, nor can obstacle after obstacle be raised via the Anthroposophical Society to hinder what spiritual science is intended to be. Among sensible people, you will always find understanding for the fact that it is precisely those who are somehow at a point of divergence in their lives, sometimes to the extent of having lost their equilibrium, who join us. The question always arises, should we move toward these people or harden our attitude? People such as this may change, may further lose their inner stability, or they may change their stories later in the way we have seen, intending to harm a sacred matter, to relegate it to the rubbish heap, to betray or to denigrate it. If what I said yesterday is unfounded, basically that what I say is heeded little, then this would be within the rights of an individual. I spoke of some non-members speaking ill of adherents and their blind faith. One doesn't need blind faith for any teaching, because it can be tested. Only for matters pertaining to arrangements is trust sometimes required. The opposite of what I intended often happens precisely in such cases. That's why what I said yesterday about the imposition of necessary measures could be felt as unfair. Yet these measures will be upheld, and so, on the other hand, will care be taken by those genuinely undertaking robust esoteric development. Let us give this time. Who knows what will come about through activities in the Anthroposophical Society? What may transpire through misunderstanding or through betrayal to the world. People who know full well how much time has been devoted to matters will convince themselves that books have appeared or are about to appear once these measures have been in place for a certain amount of time. At that time I was forced to approve the publication of cycles over which I had no control. It was not my will, but that of other people who wanted to read them. Certainly one is not obliged to resist others' will, and I gave way. But you can read the accusations that were made. It was thought to be a trick. The lecture cycles were in a style inviting criticism. Ultimately, everything can be construed as wrong through ill will. But my dear friends, if spiritual science is to be rightly related to the Anthroposophical Society, then the society must feel itself to be bound to the life of spiritual science itself. And yet how many only feel bound up with their own personal lives? In the Anthroposophical Society there really are, and there have always been, numerous people who have expressed in one form or another that they only join the Anthroposophical Society in order to discuss some esoteric matter or other with me, and who refuse to extend any trust toward people whom I myself trust. This is a particularly distressing experience. It is to no avail that I extend trust toward one friend or another in the society. Those people are not welcomed, and people try to circumvent them. Well, such things originate in so much of a personal nature being brought into the Anthroposophical Society. Do you know which word I most frequently encountered in those so-called esoteric consultations? Don't imagine I heard most frequently about issues such as freedom, equality, human evolution, and so on. The word I heard most often from every single person was I, capital. People would arrive with their most personal concerns. I would have gladly made allowance for this had it progressed beyond that point, but it simply never does so, for the reasons given yesterday, and that needs to be understood. I know that This will best be understood primarily by those who work with real devotion toward Anthroposophy's progress, by those who are able to see, in developing Anthroposophy, a task concerning humanity as a whole. Those same people who do not merely seek an easing of their family situations, or whatever other personal issues, in their joining the Anthroposophical Society, and this includes all those who seek a legally permitted little medical back door, because they would continually retreat were it a case of publicly combating materialistic medicine, people looking for a handy little back door to being cured without standing up to materialistic medicine. It is in no other way possible to continue dealing with everything that harms society from also harming the Anthroposophical Society, except by imposing the measures of which I spoke yesterday, and from which, at least in the near future, there will be no deviating. Only in this way will it be possible to eradicate what has so terribly nested in our midst. In doing this, the Anthroposophical Society will be able to thrive ever better. Likewise, Esoteric Life, I will take care that this happens, will be able to thrive. The fabrications mentioned yesterday, much depends on this, may to some extent have the rug pulled from under their feet once the two-part measures mentioned yesterday are energetically put in place. Do understand this, because in doing so you are signaling your agreement with the unique nature of the task of the Anthroposophical movement. There are enough people in the world at large who do not feel they are capable of fighting Anthroposophy, in the sense it is here intended. It is too uncomfortable and entails getting to know something about Anthroposophy, a discomfort to some wishing to oppose it. But turning a blind eye to betrayal and denigration, even spreading it, provides a means of opposing Anthroposophy without understanding it. Our contemporaries are very susceptible to betrayal and vilification. Nothing is more newsworthy. Let us seriously take hold of Anthroposophy's task. Let us take to heart the seriousness of the situation, and then all will be well with regard to those measures. This is the mood in which we wish to close. I hope that we continue in deploying our forces appropriately to work together. The end of Lecture 8.